Hello, listeners. This is Defuse. It is so good to be back in the captain's chair here on Reconstruct. Thank you guys for joining me. Let's see. I have a new release out, and this is an exclusive mix for my fans out there. You can still email me, even to comment on the show at thereconstructpodcast.com. And this mix will not be released to the general public. I'm so excited about it. It's about an hour and a half of music, and it kind of harkens back to my days in the early 2000s, but it also brings it forward to a really momentum, melodic, hypnotic, more hypnotic than anything. It combines techno, house, everything like that. So once again, if you like to listen to that and you'd like to get a free download and stream, you can go to the Reconstruct podcast at Gmail. And also you can just, I'd love to hear what you think about the show. And then lots of things going on. I've got my show in Kansas City in just over a week, and at Mod Gallery in Kansas City. I just, man, it's so good to, it's going to be good to be, get back in that city. It's got so much great underground character, and I love the people there. And I've got some friends I'm going to be really excited to get back in touch with. And you can get information on the show or anything like that. Just go to my socials at DJ Defuse. Also, thanks for everyone that's joined the show. We've got a lot of new listeners this last couple of weeks. And if you dig it and you want it to stay on the air, please share it and tell your friends.
Defuse.
Where did we leave off? So let's talk about that. So Culture Industry, we had just released a self-financed cassette. I want to thank the government because generally they gave me grants and stuff. I was working 40, 50, 60 hours a week and going to school. And so those grants helped me move forward and self-release a cassette, which looked awesome. We got it circulated as best we could, and we started getting attention. I think some of the main thing I had, we had the video that was playing every single week in Austin, and we also had a friend of mine, his name was Chris Kaz, and he was just a really great guy, and he wanted to, you know, be our manager, and we didn't have access to a manager, we didn't know, and we signed him on to just promote us and be a manager and just oversee everything that we were doing. And he paid off in spades. He was just a good guy. And one of the big gigs at that beginning was he was able to kind of do his due diligence and get in touch with one of the big radio stations in Austin. And he found out that Flock of Seagulls were playing and they didn't list an opener. So he talked to the guy and said, "Hey, what about Culture Industry? This is my band. Here's the cassette. They've got a really great following and blah, blah, blah." And as it turned out, all he had to do was donate. We got $250 to play the gig when he finalized it, but he said, "I'll turn that over to," I forget what the DJ was that worked the station, but $250 and then a bag of Coke to the guy was really how he sealed the deal. And I gotta say, that was one of the most amazing experiences I've ever had, because we had never played in front of kind of a dedicated crowd like that. And even though we were doing all original music, we didn't know if it was gonna fit. We figured it might fit. It's kind of a modern twist on what Flock of Seagulls were doing. And by the way, Flock of Seagulls were one of my favorite bands coming out of the 80s. I ran and I don't want to get tumbled up here, but I had two of their albums. I really just, like, I couldn't wait to really just meet them. Couldn't wait for the show. I couldn't believe we were opening for them. And so we do the sound check and it goes smooth, and we listen to their sound check as well. And I think it's some of the lead singers. The band was definitely not the same band. It was only the lead singer and I think not even one other member, but some of them were children of the band members and stuff like that. And the lead singer just seemed very cool and chill. And I just remember thinking, because they showed up in a van, I thought they would have this big tour bus, you know, and I couldn't wait to maybe hang out with them on the tour bus or whatever. But they just stayed in a hotel and drove in a white van. And I thought, wait a minute, this is the Flock of Seagulls. They used to play stadiums and now they're playing here and they're in a white van. And it made me really kind of, I was surprised at that time because I had just, I guess, headlights in my eyes as far as how I thought the music scene was. But as it goes, as things go on and time goes on, you start diminishing your cost of how much it does to do a tour. And I think that was the situation. But cool thing, we did a really good sound check. Everything was tight. Everything was looking good. And this is one of those nights where everything just went right. We didn't have any technical issues with our equipment. My drum set sounded great. We had practiced a lot. And the venue was sold out. It was absolutely standing room only. And we open up. They don't know who we are. And we just play our hearts out. I loved it. Jerry was over to the side. He had a cowboy hat on and a bandana and looked like we talked about, he looked like someone we just pulled off the street. And I thought it was a great look because he was very focused on his guitar and playing, and he had his energy all his own. Jeff had instead of playing live keyboards, he put a cat, which is kind of like a trigger thing where you play with drumsticks. I'm trying to think about the other stuff. Anyway, he learned how to trigger bass notes playing drumsticks on a pad, basically. And though I liked his energy and how he was just so excited about it, I just did want to tell him that, man, you know, you can't tell what you're doing. It looks like you're just banging drumsticks for no reason. It's hard to delineate the fact that that he's playing a bass line, basically, or a live keyboard part, or when he'd switch it around and stuff. That was the thing I always thought about. At the same time, he had his heart in it. He played great. And we linked together. And I just remember reaching out into the crowd and just like shaking people's hands during the performance. And, you know, looking at, we had a huge turnout from good friends that I worked with at Pepper's at the restaurant I was bartending. And everyone just kind of at that moment, and I'm just going off the cuff here, I just felt like, just like when we won the Battle of the Bands, that people were kind of seeing me as someone else, not this geeky sort of guy that was a bartender, that I actually had this music talent. And it was a solid show. And we broke down our equipment, went down and watched the Flock of Seagulls and talked with our friends and hugged, lots of hugs and everything. It was just such a big accomplishment. And so we were kind of at a point of, okay, that's it. What can we build from here? And so at that time, I met this woman named Janelle. I want to say her name was Janelle. I haven't kept in touch with her since she stood me up as far as me DJing her wedding. That's another story. But we basically connected. She was really into music, and she had been promoting of some sort before that and had some experience with promoting. And so in San Marcos, this was a key thing in my career, is that I remember that it's not about, you can do what you want as a band, but if you're not connecting with the people, then in not recognizing your target audience or not recognizing the audience that you have available to you, then you're going to fail. And this was the moment where she said, we should get sororities and fraternities involved and we should do a show together. And I just thought, what the hell does that mean? Like, how does that even make sense? These are frat boys, sorority girls, blondes, whatever you want to call them, brunettes. And these guys aren't us. They're not underground. And she said, well, your music at times is not underground. You guys hit a pop note and you play some fun stuff every now and then. So I think you could pull it off. And what I'm thinking is we'll do, and her idea was brilliant. She said, we're going to do a food drive and we're going to get everyone involved and we're going to pack Devereaux's, which is the place I talked about earlier. It was a big theater they had redone. And it was just a big live music venue, probably fit about 700 people, I guess. And so I said, okay, and I went and approached Devereaux's. I'd already had a relationship with them from my previous band and said, hey, we want to do this event, and I think we gave it a good time with. I think we gave it maybe 4 months in the future. And then we went to the food bank and handled it like business and talked to them and said, hey, we want to raise food for you and do a benefit for you, and we just need you to sign off on a benefit form. so that we could present it to restaurants, into bars, into the radio station, everything, saying this is a benefit and this is sanctioned by the government as a benefit. And so we just got to work, and she hit restaurants for sponsorships. I was responsible because I was going to school and at the radio station up in Old Main, which was the main broadcast and communication and radio area. And I said, hey, we're doing this thing. Here's our form. And we're this band, and we really want to raise food for people in need. And so they said, okay, this is great. And I couldn't believe it, because they came out. They said, okay, we're going to give you a front page, full page front. I'm sorry, not front page, but a full page ad on this. We're going to also guarantee 2 or 3 half page ads after that. And we're going to do an exclusive interview with you guys and talk about the show. And I couldn't believe it, because at that time, I think doing a full page ad was something like $500 in the school paper. I know it doesn't sound like much, but of course I can't afford that. And it just all came together. And we got, Janelle went door to door to all the fraternities saying, hey, we're all competing, and like, what do you guys want to do good for the community? Let's do this. And it was an easy win for them. And they could also donate money too. If they just didn't want to do a can drive or whatever, they could also just donate money. And that night we got thousands and thousands and thousands of food that was trucked in that night from every fraternity and sorority and everyone, because we made a competition for someone to win, to have the most pounds and money and pounds involved and everything like that. And so we had this great energy. We had people that were kind of, you know, kind of underground, kind of new culture industry, but we also had a big frat crowd. But I made sure that we kept it pretty safe. I had a DJ, I want to say his name was Jimmy Jones at that time, that I really liked his style. And he played just the perfect blend of kind of old school hip hop, The Chronic, from stuff from the album The Chronic by Dr. Dre. And he just made it smooth and he made it cool, and he put some 80s tracks in there too. So it was a great kind of segue. And we had a band that I mentioned this before, that they didn't want me as a drummer, but we had a rapport together. So I invited them to be the opening band. And also on top of this, I was at the radio station, so I made these really great, I got in the studio with Jeff, and instead of having these kind of standard issue, coming up this night, we're going to have a rave party. We did this really slicked out commercial, like it sounded like a full on live festival event, with the commercial with Voodoo Dolly and with us and with Jimmy Jones. And I had that broadcasting on there. We called it, and this is funny to me because I didn't know a lot about the rave scene. I just read about it. I'd read about it in Europe. I had a friend that showed up that was moving from Los Angeles, and she had all these flyers that had the word moonshine on them, which is funny because that'll come in later when I signed to Moonshine Records. That was what they were doing, is having these huge parties after hours and having illegal punch. And that was the big thing, is you could drink after hours and go to Moonshine. And it was thousands of people. They made a ton of money doing that event. But I would look at these flyers like they were like I'd study them. And I wanted to create that rave event. But I knew that a lot of people in San Marcos at that time were just not very educated into underground music. And it was kind of the same way in Austin at that time and everything. So we really just tried to make it underground, but also acceptable to everyone out there. So we called it CI Rave Party 1, is what we called it. That was literally what it was called. Raves were supposed to be this underground sort of thing, but we just called it a rave right over the top of the ads and everything like that. So we built up the hype, and we sold out the venue, and there were people outdoors, like 700 people were sold out. And the show, everyone did such a great time performing, and we went on stage like we were some kind of headliner. No one knew who we were, but we had positioned ourselves as headliners at this, like, this huge band, and we were selling posters. We had printed up t-shirts. We had had our cassettes for sale, and literally the booth got mobbed with people just throwing money and buying cassettes and everything. We sold out of every single item that night. And it was just, it felt like a great start. The performance was great. Once again, we didn't have technical errors or, you know, it was just tight. And I was just electrified by performing and being in front of a crowd that was literally just screaming and yelling and with music they didn't even know existed. Most of them, I would say. And just knowing that you're sharing your love for people out there, like sharing your love for music, and hopefully it'll create a spark. And so the show went down just amazingly. And we made some money, actually. You know, we made a little money, which was rare. And it was just really a great show and a great night and unbelievable. And the problem is that we had recognized that with the audience that we're with at Texas State, we realized at that time that I realized that we couldn't just creep people out of the blue. We had to involve fraternities and sororities. And my biggest problem is from that point on, I got the cocky syndrome and I said, no, I'm going to go Nine Inch Nails. And if people follow me, then cool. But if not, you know what? I don't care. And that was probably the biggest part of what we would see as an eventual kind of downfall in a way. And it taught me a lot about that you have to meet people halfway with music. You can't just say my way's right, your way's wrong, and you're dumb. And for listening to what you do, you have to meet them halfway. And that involves marketing, like we did. We covered and blanketed that town with the help of the paper. And we also put flyers out and everything like that. And we're on the radio and we did interviews and everything like that. We covered the entire spectrum, but we understood that we had to get that crowd in, a college crowd. And so the music that I played at that time, a lot of the songs that we did were party songs. One was called, Stripper. And it's me singing, I'm a male stripper in a go-go bar, like redoing that old 80s track, but basically put my own flavor to it and rapping and whatever. And we had another song called Torture Machine, which was just a fun song about this chick that, well, that's a long story on that one. A chick that literally would find guys that were rapists and things like that, and that she would go and torture them at her house when she'd find out. And so, but we made it to this bouncy beat. So it was this kind of dichotomy there. And, but basically, Bondage Room was the name of the song. Sorry about that. But anyway, we did just some cool stuff that were fun and bouncy, but all of a sudden I decided I wanted to be dark and dirty, like Nine Inch Nails and like Ministry and everything like that. And that's really when things started going a different direction. And as a DJ, that's one thing that I started realizing is that your market, I started reading it like the stock market. It takes years and years to months to kind of see where things are going. And sure, you can fight and say, my sound's right, you guys are wrong, and bang your head against the door. And I think in a big way, that's what culture industry was doing. That's what I was doing, is I'm doing this thing. If you don't like it, that's your problem. And we started losing people. And I learned that from a marketing aspect. I really did. That was a big thing in becoming Defuse, is to understand where the crowd's at, understand where the market's at. And believe me, everyone out there to know that this is a business. You can say, oh, no, man, I'm doing it for my thing. And that's cool. And create art and do what you want to do. But if you want to be successful, you have to look at it and create it as a business. And once again, and I'll be saying this over and over again, you got to meet the business halfway. You've got to meet the crowd halfway. You've got to understand where your audience is and meet them halfway. And that's just how my philosophy has been from there. And that's learning this lesson with culture industry. And I'll get into how we closed and what began with my new career as Defuse on the next episode. And I appreciate all of you guys that listen to the show. Welcome and thank you. This is Reconstruct. Email us, especially to get a copy of that new mix, the Reconstruct Podcast at gmail.com. Once again, the Reconstruct Podcast at gmail.com. Thank you.